Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start with the headline for the cover story. What's in your doc's pockets? New data on payments to Triangle physicians from pharmaceutical and medical device companies mean it's time for patients to ask the tough questions. And that's on the cover of the Triangle Business Journal. The actual article begins inside with the second headline. Pharma's top paid doctors in the Triangle. New disclosure requirements empower patients to track payments from pharma and medical device firms. And this article is written by Jason DeBruin. In 50 of the 52 weeks of 2014, Dr. Mark Reynolds of Durham received at least one payment or gift from a pharmaceutical or medical device company for a combined total of more than $338,000. From August 2013 through the end of December the following year, 518 total days, Reynolds received 615 payments or gifts valued at $471,113 spread over 205 days. These payments came from companies like Janssen Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, Otsuka America Pharmaceutical Incorporated, and Eli Lilly. Reynolds, who did not reply to requests for comment, is far from alone. In fact, millions of his peers across the country, including thousands of doctors just in the Triangle, collectively amassed at least $2.5 billion last year in payments from pharmaceutical companies and medical equipment companies for line items including lunches, speeches, and stock options. The figure increases when adding research payments to the mix. While such payments are not illegal, the recent availability of data on the pervasive use of such relationships between doctors and vendors have started a conversation of ethics, patient disclosure, and backdoor relationships. Data on these transactions is now available through the Open Payments Program under the Affordable Care Act, offering patients much broader insight into the cash and gifts flowing from pharmaceutical and medical device companies to thousands of doctors. In the Triangle, doctors received $24 million in 2014 alone from more than 500 different pharmaceutical or medical device companies for payments that include promotional speaking, consulting fees, food and beverage, travel and lodging, and more. The data try to capture a wide range of payments. For example, a doctor who attends an educational conference in which a drug company sponsors the lunch might find her name on the list because the drug company will simply divide the cost of the lunch by all doctors in attendance. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, which publishes the data, makes the point that the data, quote, is not intended to signify an inappropriate relationship, unquote. In the same breath, however, it adds that, quote, these relationships may also influence research, education, and clinical decision-making in ways that compromise clinical integrity and patient care and may potentially lead to increased health care costs, unquote. At the very least, information on the dollar amounts and frequency of payments can empower patients to make their own decisions about whether to accept prescriptions for medications from companies that put money in their physicians' pockets. Drug and device promotion. The pharmaceutical industry alone spends about $30 billion per year promoting products, with 90% of that money directed to physicians and other prescribers, according to estimates based on research published in Annals of Internal Medicine. Marketing relationships between physicians and healthcare companies can introduce conflicts of interest that influence prescribing, research, education, use, and ultimately patient outcomes, and there is substantial evidence that this is often in ways that favor the company's interests, write the authors. The prevalence of such relationships, their effect on the healthcare system, and inadequate disclosure helped spur legislators to create the Open Payments Program. The Open Payments Program, which began as the Physician Payment Sunshine Act of 2007 and was enacted as part of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, reveals that in North Carolina, as in the Triangle, top dollars went to just a few doctors. From August 2013 through December 2014, 168 doctors in North Carolina received $100,000 or more apiece, representing less than 1% of the 20,042 North Carolina doctors captured in the data. Conversely, more than 3 out of 4 doctors received less than $1,000 in that time frame, and 15% received 25 or less, according to the data. The history. While the Sunshine Act data is new, in reality, it expands policies already in place for more than a decade by many academic medical institutions. In the 1980s and 1990s, pharmaceutical representatives grew ever more cozy with doctors, probably leading to some inappropriate relationships, experts agree. Years ago, drug companies were getting, quote, creative in how they would provide support to doctors, unquote, says Robert Seligson, CEO of the North Carolina Medical Society, which has fully supported the transparency initiative. I would agree there was abuse going on and maybe undue influence, he says. Toward the late 1990s and early 2000s, academic medical institutions began requiring their doctors to fill out conflict of interest forms. And now every institution that receives federal funding for research is required to have a conflict of interest policy. UNC doctors, for example, must ask permission for certain professional activities with industry. This policy rubs with that policy, says Leanne Walker, UNC School of Medicine Director of Compliance and Research Integrity, comparing the academic conflict of interest disclosures with the open payments data, which covers every doctor, not just those affiliated with academia. The role of royalties. The doctor who received the most money in North Carolina is neurosurgeon Dr. Kimberly Livingston of Raleigh. She received $2.16 million from Covidian LP. Those payments are not for speaking engagements or travel, but in stock, stock option, or any other ownership interest, according to the federal data. That amount represents 90% of Covidian LP's payments in the triangle, although Covidian Sales LLC also spent money on doctors in the triangle. Similarly, NuVasive made payments of a combined $1.4 million to Durham neurosurgeon Dr. Robert Isaacs and orthopedic surgeons Dr. Christopher Brown of Durham and Dr. Govinder Dial of Raleigh, characterized as royalty or license. The amount represents 90% of NuVasive's total payments in the triangle. Physicians can help medical device companies make improvements that benefit patients. These physicians then receive royalties for their work based on sales of those devices. Importantly, however, physicians typically do not receive royalties on those devices used by that physician or any other physician in the practice, say both hospital and pharmaceutical representatives. Such ethics policies, while not explicitly mandated, apply broadly in healthcare, according to hospital and pharma executives. To bring the most innovative spine surgery solutions to market, NuVasive regularly partners with the best minds in the business with the goal of transforming spine surgery through the advancement of technology that provides better patient outcomes, faster recovery times, and enhanced economic value to the healthcare system, says Stacy Rohan, a NuVasive representative. As reflected in the Sunshine Act data, Dr. Brown has assisted NuVasive with the design and development of several surgical implants and related instrumentation for use in spine surgery. In the triangle, stock or royalty payments by Covidian, NuVasive, and Stryker Corporation totaled $4.6 million, or about 20% of the payments made to Triangle doctors in 2014. Casting a wider net. Pharma giant Pfizer employs a different strategy. While its individual payments were smaller, the pharma giant reached a far greater number of doctors. Only 7 of its 3,332 payments were for more than $9,000. Conversely, some $3,000 payments were for payments of about $100 or less, nearly all of which were classified as food and beverage. For context, Covidien LP made 229 total payments. NuVasive paid 10 doctors. A Pfizer spokesman argues the payments foster an educational relationship. The interactions provide healthcare professionals with up-to-date information about medicines and help drug and device companies better understand the needs of doctors and their patients and work to improve the treatments and services they provide, writes Dean Mastrojohn. The spokesman says in an email, if a patient sees his or her doctor listed on the CMS Open Payment site and has questions, they should feel free to ask their doctor directly. Biopharmaceutical companies research and deliver new medical innovations, and interactions with company representatives provide evidence-based information to physicians on benefits, risks, and appropriate uses of medicines. It's up to individual physicians to develop treatment plans for their patients, drawing on evidence-based information from many sources, including the companies that study and make medicines. The American College of Physicians, however, warns against doctors becoming too cozy with pharmaceutical reps, even if the dollar values for any individual interaction might seem small. The college calls on physicians to be conscious of potential influences on clinical decision-making that might affect the best interests of patients, summarizes the authors in the Annals piece. Will patients ask? Experts agree the data isn't perfect. For example, it lacks a fuller context, points out Heather Pierce, Senior Director of Science Policy and Regulatory Council at the Association of American Medical Colleges. The data does not differentiate between a physician who simply attended a large educational conference with a catered lunch or one who spent an evening at a steakhouse with a pharmaceutical representative, for example. Transparency requires context, and without the right context, you run the risk of having more noise than helpful information, says Pierce, though quickly adding that this is a good start. Also, the data can seem daunting. Simply opening the Open Payments database pulls up 11 million records from 1,444 companies to 607,000 doctors, daunting figures even to a spreadsheet wizard. It's even hard for me to make sense of it, and I deal with it on a daily basis, says Walker, the UNC compliance director. Still, those who deal with the data, including Walker and Pierce, say the Obama administration made the data far more user-friendly in the second year. A search tool available through the CMS data provides a good shortcut for patients, even if they don't consider themselves tech-savvy. Before this kind of data makes its way into the forefront of the American patient's consciousness, however, Neil Kirshner, American College of Physicians Senior Associate of Regulatory and Insurer Affairs and co-author of the Annals piece, says patients need a cultural change. The reality is that even when you look at insurers or different payers that provide quality data or cost information, there is still only a small fraction who are using the data, he says. I guess it is a type of cultural change that needs to take place for patients to be better advocates of their own care and to be aware of data that's available. In concert with other experts, Kirshner adds that the college has been very supportive of healthcare transparency across the board. Most importantly, the database offers a good way for patients to start conversations with their doctors. Even with the Hippocratic Oath in place, patients should not blindly trust their doctors or ignore payments, particularly in the tens of hundreds of thousands from pharmaceutical and medical device companies. It's designed to make sure you are fully informed, says Bobby Higdon, a former prosecutor now with the Williams Mullen Law Firm, who provides counsel to clients on anti-kickback laws and bribery laws. In the same way that patients have a right to know about their surgeon's ownership interest in a surgery center, they now have the right to know about a doctor's relationship with a drug company. Health experts agree that more transparency can lead only to better health outcomes. It's a great way to start a conversation, says Pierce. A physician should be able to tell someone why it is they are doing the work they are doing for a company. And along with this article, there is a listing called The Recipients, Triangle Doctors Who Received the Most Payments in 2014, $2.16 million. Kimberly Livingston, neurological surgery. $1.27 million, Robert Isaacs, neurological surgery. $1.15 million, Robert Lippitt, urology. $973,000, Christopher Brown, orthopedic surgery. $556,000, Gary Felker, internal medicine, cardiovascular disease. $549,000, Gurvinder Diol, orthopedic surgery. $510,000, Richard Sykes, psychiatry. $498,000, Jeffrey Marcus, surgery, plastic and reconstructive surgery. $471,000, Mark Reynolds, psychiatry and neurology, psychiatry. And $433,000, R. Williams, internal medicine, cardiovascular disease. And another section with this cover story is marked Payments to Hospitals. Payments made by pharmaceutical and medical device companies to Triangle Teaching Hospitals in 2014 includes funding for research. WakeMed, while counted as a teaching hospital, does not perform research like academic medical universities. $57,072, WakeMed Health and Hospitals. $2.39 million, UNC Hospitals. $9.21 million, Duke University Hospital. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by Managing Editor Rebecca Troyer. Tiger visits Wyndham. On a wet August 19 morning, Biz wanted to get the lowdown from McConnell Golf CEO John McConnell, who owns the Donald Ross-designed Sedgefield Country Club golf course, home of the Wyndham Championship in Greensboro. The tournament is a big deal this year because Tiger Woods is playing at the championship for the first time. So Biz wondered if McConnell was hanging out with Tiger. Shortly thereafter, Biz received a photo, taken minutes before McConnell started his round with Tiger. Wyndham Worldwide CEO Franz Hanning and basketball superstar Chris Paul, a Wake Forest University alum who also happens to be a good friend of Woods. The four were playing in the Louis DeJoy and Aldana Zewus Family Foundation Pro-Am. Tiger mentioned to me that he liked the course and felt the greens were really good, McConnell tells Biz. He played 18, but I am not sure on score, but at least 2-under. New brews come to town. Virginia's largest craft brewery, Devil's Backbone, held a VIP event at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences on August 17 to showcase its craft beer that recently made its way to bottle shops and grocery stores in the area. Many local store representatives were on hand to sample the beer and mingle with the Devil's Backbone's co-founders, Steve Crandall and Heidi Crandall, head brewer Jason Oliver, and other brewery employees. Local shops represented that night included Wine 101, Glass Jug, Triangle Wine Company, Crafty Beer Shop, Dee's Bottle Shop and Craft Beer College, and area Total Wine and More shops. Also seen enjoying the evening's events were Crank Arm Brewing Company's co-owner brewer Mike Morris and Big Boss Brewing Company's co-owner brewer Brad Wynn. With Devil's Backbone looking to produce around 65,000 barrels by the end of this year, craft beer aficionados can expect to see many new beers on Triangle shelves, including the Vienna Lager, 8-Point IPA, Schwartz Beer, and the Bravo 4-Point Session IPA. Carrie Teen takes silver at Microsoft Contest. 16-year-old Cary resident Ryan Katalfu just beat out 600,000 worldwide participants, winning a silver medal in the Microsoft Word 2010 World Championship. Entrants had to compete to demonstrate their mastery of Microsoft Office products, and 145 student finalists from 47 countries participated in the final round of competition. Katalfu finished second after Manuel Burgos of the Dominican Republic. Along with a trophy and Microsoft products, Katalfu netted $3,750 in scholarship money. And in a section called You Said It, on the Business Pulse poll, which Triangle-based ACC school has the most spirit? I vote for normalizing the results according to the size of the schools. Go Duke. That's from Oren Cohen. And on the story, report Durham is number 2 best college town in U.S. It means they did not visit Raleigh. That's from Jim Wheeler. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page in the Triangle Business Journal. The first headline, New Durham Neighborhood to Pair with Organic Farm as Part of Amenity Package. Durham County's Board of Commissioners has given its overwhelming approval to a Durham developer's plan to build what is expected to be the region's first housing community with its own organic fruit and vegetable farm. Development of Wet Rock Farm on a 230-acre site along NC 501 in North Durham means 141 homes alongside 130 acres of preserved forest land with jogging trails and picnic areas. The property is about a 20-minute drive from downtown Durham, but the more unique amenity of Wet Rock Farm will be its 15-acre professionally managed organic farm that will be offered as a food source and educational tool for its residents. Developer Rick Bagel of Wet Rock Resources LLC of Durham says it's the first of its kind in North Carolina. Our project will exceed other farm-based communities in the country by offering greater interaction between the farm, the residents, and the local community. Bagel says he already has letters of intent to sell a combined 74 home sites to 2 home builder companies from Durham and from Chapel Hill, but he declined to identify the builders until plans were more concrete. Wet Rock Resources is also still working to secure the project's financial equity and debt partners to begin pre-development of the property in fall 2015. Bagel says he expects the first homes to break ground in early 2016. After protests from neighbors, Top Golf pulls out of Cary Town Center, seeks alternative site. Top Golf and the managers of Cary Town Center Mall have dropped their plans to add a mega entertainment and indoor golf complex to the Cary Mall property amid protests from some of the mall's neighboring residents and businesses. Top Golf was working with the owner of Cary Town Center Mall, Tennessee-based CBL & Associates Properties, to replace the vacant Sears store with a new 3-story entertainment complex that would have an indoor golf driving range, restaurant, and rooms for other games. Cary's Planning and Zoning Board voted in May to recommend approval of the mall owner's request to rezone the site to allow for a 60-foot building, a requirement for Topgolf's prototype 3-story building. But several neighbors of the mall on Walnut Street complained that the taller buildings and the illumination from the driving range would hurt their property values and quality of life. Members of the nearby Triangle Aquatic Center were also concerned that it would lose access to parking spaces next to the mall complex. Topgolf spokeswoman Adrienne Chance confirmed via email that the company is, quote, no longer pursuing, unquote, a location at Cary Town Center Mall. CBL was a fantastic partner to us, and we're extremely grateful for their time and support, she said. Unfortunately, however, as we were testing during due diligence, we became concerned about our ability to sufficiently mitigate the lighting and noise issues for the local neighborhood. The last thing we want to be is a nuisance to the people living close to one of our locations. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page written by Jason DeBruin. The first headline, Sprouts Potential Lures Valeant to $1 billion Buy. A whirlwind week for Cindy Whitehead and Sprout Pharmaceuticals continued August 20 as Canadian-based Valeant Pharmaceuticals bought the company for $1 billion in cash. The deal includes $500 million when the acquisition closes and another $500 million in the first quarter of 2016. Sprout, which occupies a small office in the North Hills area of Raleigh, had raised $100 million from private investors. The Valiant deal comes 2 days after Sprout received approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for Adderall, the first ever approved treatment to boost women's libido. Adderall is approved to treat hypoactive sexual desire disorder, HSDD, but the FDA approval came with serious warnings about side effects. This marks the second time in 5 months that Valiant has made a big splash in Raleigh. Early this year, Valiant bought Salix Pharmaceuticals for $11 billion. Salix, a maker of gastrointestinal drugs, is a homegrown Raleigh company. The Valiant Salix deal has many differences from the Sprout deal, however. Salix had 22 products on the market, recorded more than $1 billion in revenue in 2014, and employed more than 250 in Raleigh. Adderall is Sprout's first drug. The company has no revenue and employs 34 workers. In the Salix deal, Valiant quickly laid off 258 workers, matching a model it employed in previous acquisitions. The Sprout deal, however, might be different. Valiant says Sprout will become its own division within the company, and that Whitehead and her entire team will join Valiant. On August 19, Whitehead announced plans to hire a specialty sales force and expand the company to 200 workers, but those plans might change with the acquisition. Whitehead also said Sprout would not immediately market Adderall directly to consumers, choosing instead to educate doctors on the drug. That could also change. Executives from Valiant and Sprout did not offer sales projections or give a marketing strategy. They did not divulge the names of any investors or give sales estimates beyond disclosing that it expects no impact to Valiant's 2015 earnings and moderate accretion to 2016 earnings. This partnership with Valiant allows us the capacity to now ensure broader, more affordable access to all the women who have been waiting for this treatment, Whitehead said. Beyond building this in the United States, Valiant also offers us a global footprint that could eventually bring Adderall to women across the globe. BioAgilytics charts more growth. Jim Dayton has a lot to smile about these days. The company he leads, BioAgilytics, doubled its customer base from 2013 to 2014 and already doubled again by August of this year. The company has 60% organic year-over-year growth, and Dayton expects to acquire a company in Europe by the end of the year. The company does not disclose revenue, but in 2013, when it placed on the Inc. 5000 list, it recorded $17.1 million in revenue. The company employed 72 workers at the beginning of this year, but has already grown to about 84. Now the board approved Dayton to hire 29 more. These hires include senior staff like a chief finance officer and heads for departments like operations, marketing, and human resources. Dayton boasts the company's employee retention rate is 94%. This is such an easy area to recruit, he says, using as a case in point a job candidate from California who was stunned at the difference in real estate prices in the Triangle compared to California. BioAgilytics fits in what is called the contract research organization industry, in which it helps drug developers test experimental drugs. The company focuses on large molecule drugs, meaning biologics, biosimilars, vaccines, hormones, and the like, which currently make up about half of the new drug pipeline. And in a section called By the Numbers, $44.75, price per share that major shareholders of Inc. Research sold in a secondary offering, netting $352 million in the sale. Shares were sold by the institutional investors, and the company received no money. $447 million. UNC Chapel Hill's record-setting fundraising year in 2014 to 2015, buoyed largely by a $100 million commitment from pharmaceutical magnate and pharmacy school alum Fred Eshelman. $270,833. Amount of Affordable Care Act funds going to the Carrboro Community Health Center to improve primary health care in the area. $55,000. Individuals in North Carolina who bought Affordable Care Act health insurance plans during the special enrollment period, half of whom did so because they lost other coverage. $5.2 million. Grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to consortium led by Duke University to study the extraction, development, and commoditization of various products from algae for cheaper renewable energy. And finally, in a he said it section, that will delay results by a quarter. No reason to worry. Sophisticated investors understand that, but not all investors are in that category. And that's from Rahul Jasuja, Managing Director of Biotechnology Research at Noble Life Science Partners, commenting on a 20% share price dip for Durham's BioCryst Pharmaceuticals. In releasing quarterly results on August 7, BioCryst reported it would add slightly to a study of one of its experimental drugs, something that spooked investors. Shares rallied, though had not fully recovered by August 19. And now we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, Open Source Automation Startup to Expand in Durham. An open source technology firm has targeted Durham for growth. Ansible, an IT automation startup, has nearly doubled its Durham headcount this year to 50. Now, armed with a brand new 10,000 square foot headquarters overlooking the Durham Bulls Athletic Park, execs say they're readying for even more hires. The goal is to be at 85 by the end of 2015 and to hire an additional 30 in 2016. While the CEO remains in Silicon Valley, the bulk of the employees, including the entire engineering team, are in Durham, close to Red Hat, where many of the executives got their corporate starts. Like many technology companies that have picked Durham for an East Coast headquarters, executives cite the talent. Tim Kramer, the Durham-based Senior Vice President of Engineering, says there's plenty of it here, pointing to programs such as the Iron Yard Academy, which offers an intensive and expensive boot camp for top computer talent in the Bull City as one recruitment tool. But Kramer, who moved here from Santa Barbara, California, will tell you that it's not just local talent that Ansible is employing. It's recruiting from other areas and other Ansible offices. Chief Technology Officer Tim Gerla, for example, came from Seattle. And it doesn't just come back to the aesthetics of the new campus. Kramer says it's about livability. Compared to Santa Barbara, Durham's dollars just go farther, he says. The cost of living and the entrepreneurial energy has Ansible team members from outside of Durham requesting transfers to the Triangle. And as long as Ansible keeps growing, its Durham headcount will remain a priority, he says. Ansible currently has 10 open engineering positions, both front-end and back-end, and is looking for a variety of skills, including Python fluency. The goal is to get the team in one place so it can innovate collaboratively, Kramer says. One of the things we're trying to do is to get as much of the team local as possible, Kramer says. And that's Durham. To keep them at their desks, the team is creating an office environment that they'll want to come to each day, he says, complete with a kegerator and ballpark views. Flower Power Kids launches big franchise plans, 50 stores in 5 years, and that's Flower spelled F-L-O-U-R. Culinary entrepreneur Susan Caldwell's Raleigh-founded Flower Power Kids Cooking Studios is branching out across the Southeast with a bullish plan to open 50 franchise locations in 5 years. That's on top of the 3 corporate-owned locations she's currently operating in Raleigh and Charlotte, which are already in line to ink $1 million in revenue in 2015, she says. Flower Power's story begins in 2008. That's when Caldwell's dramatic weight loss, losing 123 pounds and dropping 14 dress sizes, was featured in a special issue of People magazine. Caldwell became a personal trainer, initially to aid in her own weight loss journey, which took place primarily at a now-closed gym, Tone Up in Falls River in North Raleigh, but her new exposure had her using her skills in different ways. "People started hiring me to work with their children to help them be more physically fit," she says. She started a kid-oriented fitness program, and to introduce healthy eating habits, she held kids' cooking workshops, workshops that soon overshadowed the fitness routines in popularity. Kids who would cringe when a parent put out a vegetable on their plates were happily eating the pizza they made topped with zucchini. Kids tend to eat more healthily and eat new things if they cook it themselves, she says. People thought she was crazy when she decided to turn that aspect of the program into a standalone business, initially operating out of her home in North Raleigh in 2008. The trial run was so popular she had to ship her family out of the house every weekend. She took out a home equity line of credit to fund her business, which she has since paid back, and in 2009 leased half of Tone Up, turning it into a kitchen. In 2011, the company trekked to North Hills, a 2,800-square-foot space with room for two kitchens, adding an etiquette program for kids and a corporate team-building workshop for grown-ups. And finally, in the He Said It section, e-commerce has this interesting problem. If you look at the lowest sales day, say mid-July, and the highest sales day, Cyber Monday, the Monday after Thanksgiving, there's a really big swing in there, definitely greater than 10 times. From a computer science perspective, that's a hard problem because there's no way of getting around the fact that you need to have enough servers for Cyber Monday. But boy, do you feel silly on July 15th when all the needles are below 10%. This makes e-commerce a great fit for cloud because your cloud providers allow you to say, wow, it's Thanksgiving. I'm going to short-term lease 1,000 computers for the next 60 days and give them back to you on January 1. In fact, this dynamic is what led Amazon. And that's from Scott Wingo, chairman of Channel Advisor, on why cloud is a good fit for the e-commerce space. And now we turn to the On Transportation page, written by Jeff Jeffrey. Complaints against airlines rise in 2015. Passengers traveling out of Raleigh-Durham International Airport must be getting antsy this year. Consumer complaints filed with the federal government against airlines at RDU during the first 8 months of 2015 are nearly where they were for all of last year, according to data provided by the U.S. Department of Transportation. The spike in complaints comes amid moves by some airlines to sharply reduce the number of seats on flights serving RDU. So far, American Airlines tops the list at RDU in customer complaints. Of the 28 complaints filed this year, nearly one in three was against American. Add in the complaints filed against U.S. Airways, which merged with American earlier this year, and the number of complaints filed against those two airlines accounts for 40% of all those filed in 2015. American Airlines strives to provide safe, dependable, and friendly air transportation to our customers, and we work hard to make each experience a positive one, says American Airlines spokeswoman Katie Cody. Although we are successful in this effort most of the time, there are times when things do not go as smoothly as we and you would like. The airlines flying into and out of RDU received 33 complaints in 2014 and 36 in 2013. Common gripes included delayed or canceled flights, missed connections, and problems with baggage, including items stolen from checked baggage. Consumers also reported problems with fees and airlines failing to provide accommodations when passengers missed their flights, as well as access issues for elderly passengers. RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin says consumer complaints made through the US DOT website are not passed to the airport. RDU has a separate consumer feedback system for fielding passenger concerns. The number of US DOT complaints filed against airlines at RDU tracks with national statistics. Across the country this year, consumers have lodged 12,518 complaints with US DOT. Putting the nation's airlines on pace to exceed the 15,538 complaints they received in 2014. Triangle firms awarded NCDOT contracts. A Moore County contractor has landed two multi-million-dollar contracts to resurface highways in two Triangle counties. Riley Paving Company of Carthage picked up a contract to resurface 23 miles of Chatham County roads. The project, which is expected to cost $2.6 million, will affect U.S. 421 from Lee County to Plank Road, NC 87 from the roundabout to DeGraffenreit Road, and 12 sections of secondary roads. Crews are scheduled to begin as early as August 31, and work is expected to be complete by this time next year. The company has also landed a contract to resurface 19 miles of roads in Moore County at a cost of $2.2 million. That project will affect NC 22 from NC 2 to Warrior Woods Road. It will also affect six sections of secondary roads. It could begin as early as September 8 and is expected to be finished by July 2016. The two contracts are the latest in a series given to local contractors for multi-million dollar projects in the Triangle. Last month, NCDOT awarded a $2 million contract to Carolina Sunrock LLC of Raleigh for resurfacing work on 19 miles of roadway in Alamance and Orange counties. NCDOT tapped ST Wooten Corporation of Wilson to resurface more than 12 miles of roads in Lee County for a cost of $22 million. Finally, Johnson Brothers Utility and Paving Company of Lillington landed an $8.1 million contract to resurface nearly 45 miles of roads in Harnett County and another 17.4 miles in Cumberland County. And finally, in a section called By the Numbers, report Triangle Tech energy firms to add jobs. A new report released by the Research Triangle Clean Tech Cluster found technology and energy companies in the area expect to hire new employees within the next 5 years. 3,300. Number of new hires Triangle Tech and energy companies expect to make. 84%. Amount of companies that expect to bring on new employees. 47%. Amount of companies that said their top priority was to hire software programming employees. 7.6. Strength of the Triangle's talent pool based on a 10-point scale. And now we turn to the A Better World page in the Triangle Business Journal, written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline on his column, Agency Serves Rural Residents. When Reverend Sharon Freeland was growing up in Hillsboro, local residents regularly pitched in to help their neighbors in times of need. If you were hungry in the community and your neighbors knew you were hungry, you weren't hungry anymore, she says. There was a lot of giving. In 1981, recognizing that as individual organizations, they could not handle all the requests for emergency assistance they were getting, three local churches formed Orange Congregations in Mission, or OCIM, a nonprofit that would serve people in the rural northern part of Orange County facing crises in their lives. Today, with nearly 50 member congregations that each contributes half of 1% of their annual operating budget, OCIM delivers meals, provides emergency assistance, and operates a thrift shop. The nonprofit also faces rising demand in the face of economic uncertainty and an influx of new residents attracted to a part of the county with lower living costs than the pricier Chapel Hill to the south. And with growth has come a loss of connection to the community. We don't know our neighbors anymore, says Freeland, executive director of OCIM and associate pastor of Mount Bright Baptist Church. OCIM aims to raise $2 million in a capital campaign for a new facility that would double its 10,000 square foot headquarters in Hillsboro. Operating with an annual budget of nearly $855,000, a staff of four employees working full time and five working part time, and 120 to 135 active volunteers, OCIM last year served 11,000 people through its Samaritan Relief Ministry. The Orange County Department of Social Services referred most of those clients to OCIM, which provided food to nearly 9,000 of them, and also provided clothing and financial assistance. Through its Meals on Wheels program, OCIM last year served more than 7,000 meals. It generates about 15% of its annual budget from a thrift shop that sells new and gently used items of clothing, furniture, and other products donated by businesses and individuals. OCIM also serves as a resource for people seeking assistance, referring them to other agencies that provide services and support. The nonprofit also partners with other local agencies. The Department of Social Services, for example, refers to OCIM people who need food, financial assistance, or other support. OCIM provides individuals and families referred to it with a week's worth of food up to six times a year. In addition to financial support from its member congregations, OCIM counts on its members, who serve as volunteers and donors, for its pantry and deliver meals through its Meals on Wheels program. And OCIM, which has begun the quiet phase of the capital campaign to raise money for its new facility, will benefit from an annual softball tournament in September. Things have changed greatly since I came on board in 1991, Freeland says. The need is much greater. And in nonprofit news, racing for Make-A-Wish Eastern North Carolina. Gigi's Cupcakes, Briar Creek, will host the second Gigi's Cupcakes 5K at Briar Creek in Raleigh on October 17. This year's event is sponsored by Upstream Benefits, with all proceeds benefiting Make-A-Wish Eastern North Carolina. CPA firm volunteers, donates food. Dixon Hughes Goodman, LLP, recently donated 270,875 pounds of food to food banks as part of the fourth annual Count the Cans campaign. The Raleigh office donated 10,393 cans of food to the Food Bank of Eastern North Carolina. Employees from the Raleigh office also volunteered more than 60 hours of their time. Giving back to our communities is at the core of who we are as a firm and as individuals, said Matt Snow, DHG Chief Executive Officer. Habitat Restore now open in Wake Forest. Habitat for Humanity Restore is now open in Wake Forest at the Market at Wake Forest Shopping Center. The new store marks the fifth Restore in Wake County. The Habitat for Humanity of Wake County Restore sells donated building materials, furniture, and goods to support Habitat for Humanity's mission of providing resources for every person to have a decent and safe place to live. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, and we start with the Editor's Notebook. And this is written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Amazon story reflects workplace realities. After reading the detailed New York Times piece on the workplace conditions and employee expectations at retail giant Amazon, I was getting close to canceling my Amazon Prime account. But I decided to wait for CEO Jeff Bezos to respond before making a move. Not surprisingly, Bezos came out and stated he did not recognize the Amazon portrayed by the newspaper. For people who have not read the Times story, Amazon was portrayed as a company that operates similarly to the way wild animals behave in the Serengeti in Africa, survival of the strongest. Talking about this system of meritocracy, the authors wrote that employees often burst into tears and that workers backstab each other to get ahead. The authors even talked about a woman with breast cancer being put on a job improvement plan. There were many more startling examples. So obviously, as a person who regularly supports the company by buying goods and services through its portal, I was getting disgusted and mad. And most likely so did many of you. But let's lean back and think about this for a minute. Is this the price of innovation? Is this the price of competition in the tech sector? Is this the price of convenience? To me, the answer to all these questions is an emphatic yes. I am far from condoning the managerial tactics at Amazon, as published by the Times, but culture and competition often are masked in compromises. We may not think about it, but there is a cost associated with expecting Amazon to deliver my high-protein, uber-nutritious dog food in 24 hours, even if I am paying $7.99, $7.99 for the rush delivery. Someone is under pressure to make that delivery happen. Now think of the millions of people are doing this every day. If the company does not deliver, its business model collapses. Amazon has made living our lives easier and richer, and so has Google, Uber, Twitter, and scores of companies that opened its doors in the last few years. We do not want to know how these companies do what they do as long as they do it. And when you couple that with fat wages, robust stock options, and hourly deadlines, workplace culture and expectations are vastly different than what our parents went through. To a large extent, this paradigm shift, tied to innovation and quality of life products and services, most certainly is disrupting work-life balances and relationships. That's the price of innovation. And for the record, I kept my Amazon Prime account. And the other Viewpoint article is headlined, Economic Segregation Alive and Well. And this is written by Cedric Johnson, who writes about budget and tax issues at the North Carolina General Assembly for the North Carolina Justice Center in Raleigh. For poor minority families and students, economic segregation serves as a formidable barrier to opportunity. A map produced by EdBuild, a national nonprofit that focuses on public education, highlights the stark economic segregation that exists among public schools across the country. EdBuild's assessment of more than 13,000 school districts and respective poverty rates across the U.S. shows huge disparities in income levels among school districts. In many cases, school districts with dramatically different income levels are next-door neighbors or even reside within one another. In the U.S., the public school a student attends is typically determined by where their family lives, EdBuild notes. Furthermore, a significant share of funding for public schools comes from local funding sources, particularly property taxes. Accordingly, disparities in local economic wealth between affluent and distressed communities impact the level of resources available for local communities to invest in their public schools. Following a national trend, North Carolina has high levels of economic segregation across the state. A large number of the state's school districts, around 40 school districts, have student poverty rates of 30% or higher based on EdBuild's analysis. Six schools districts have student poverty rates of more than 40%. Thomasville City Schools, 51.4%. Lexington City Schools, 47.2%. Weldon City Schools, 47.1%. Halifax County Schools, 42.2%. Robeson County Schools, 40.8%. And Scotland County Schools, 40.1%. Economic segregation among school districts in North Carolina and nationally aligns with other data regarding the economic security of families. The Annie E. Casey Foundation's 2015 Kids Count report highlights the state of child well-being. For North Carolina, one in four children lives in poverty, the 11th highest child poverty rate in the country. One in three children lives in a family where the parent lacks secure employment, and one in three children lives in a family that struggles to afford the cost of housing. Overall, North Carolina ranks 35th among states for child well-being. In recent years, state lawmakers have passed tax changes that reduced and eliminated state funding to local governments and that limited their authority and ability to raise revenue from local sources. These state-level actions heighten the challenge faced by local communities to ensure that adequate funding is available for public schools and other public services. Ensuring that all North Carolina children are afforded a high-quality education requires strong state-level support. As EdBuild highlights, the varying levels of economic health among local communities creates different outcomes in local communities. Amid state-level policy changes in recent years, some local governments have been able to use their local taxing authority and pass referenda that increase revenue to adequately fund their public schools, early childhood programs, transit initiatives, and other infrastructure. Other local governments, however, are less positioned to raise local revenue for such purposes due to their limited tax base. Consequently, disparities in opportunity result and widen over time. Accordingly, a financial model that ensures all public schools are adequately funded regardless of where they are located in the state would address the existing economic segregation reality and promote healthy, safe, and thriving local communities. And for our remaining time, we'll read the People on the Move spotlight in the Triangle Business Journal. And this is on Andy Miller, Director of Raleigh Operations at Southeastern Construction and Development. Construction veteran Andy Miller has been tapped to build the Raleigh Office of Southeastern Construction and Development, or SEC, from the ground up. In addition to expanding SEC's new Raleigh office, Miller is responsible for developing new clients and projects, as well as overseeing the entire project base within the Triangle and the eastern portion of North Carolina. The goal is to complete the Raleigh office expansion by spring 2016, Miller says. SEC is based in Charlotte and is helmed by founder and president David Fry and partner Kevin Smith. What is one thing you wish people knew about your job? Communication is a key element in my position. I have to be able to communicate in a variety of manners to be able to speak clearly and competently with workers, city officials, customers, co-workers, and more. What are some of the major goals in this position? One of my major goals is to be able to have a complete office by spring of 2016. That is a very specific goal, though. On a more broad note, I want to have an impact on the construction industry in the Triangle area. Biggest pet peeve? Lack of punctuality. I am always 10 minutes early to all of my meetings. And we'll stop right there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. But be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.